Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is not an exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
Caring is central to our lives as social beings. Caring for babies and children, for those living with illness and disability, and caring as we age underpins so much of what matters for us in our society. Caring for our environment and creating healthy spaces for living rewards our physical and mental health. Caring for people and place is central to our well-being and to our humanity. Yet providing care is frequently unpaid or low-paid. Young people are not commonly encouraged into caring work. Caring in our society is sometimes seen as a distraction from the real work. So what would happen if we placed caring as a central tenet as policy in Australia? Caring for people, caring for place. Would this help create a happier and healthier society? Welcome to Policy Forum Pod, the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its regions. Today's podcast comes with a hashtag, #ValueCaring, as we dive into caring, its role in our society, its value, and how a focus on caring might change our world. I'm Anna Greta Hunter. I'm a cardiologist and physician, and I'm the Human Futures Fellow at the College of Health and Medicine here at the Australian National University. And I'm delighted to be in the studio today with my co-host, Sharon. How are you?
Hi, Anna Greta. I'm really well, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation. We've been talking about doing this for a while, and this theme of caring and valuing caring just comes up again and again in our conversations.
It does. I don't think we've done a podcast where it wasn't at least a side theme. So I think it's a really great way to unify some of the things we recognise as important.
Absolutely. And for those listeners that don't know me, I'm Sharon Bessel. I'm Professor of Public Policy at the Crawford School at the ANU.
So this is Policy Forum Pod, and Policy Forum Pod is produced by policyforum.net. We're part of the Crawford School of Public Policy, and the Crawford School is the Asia Pacific's leading graduate policy school. We've got some great short courses and graduate and degree programs, and you can check that out at crawford.anu.edu.au/study. So Sharon, who have we got to talk to us today about the value of caring?
We have two amazing guests that we have been wanting to get together in the studio for quite some time now. So we're very excited. We have Dr. Elise Klein. Elise is a colleague here at the Crawford School, where she is a senior lecturer of public policy. She has a really wide range of research interests, including the rise of therapeutic cultures in policies, neoliberal subjectivities, economic rights, and decoloniality. And Elise does a lot of work around this idea of caring and the value of care. She has two books, which include Developing Minds, Psychology, Neoliberalism and Power, and Reading a March Ascends, Inequality Reexamined. And excitingly, Elise and I are working on a paper together at the moment about the value of care. So we'll be plugging that on the podcast when we finally have that published. Elise has also held roles on the United Nations Secretary General's High-Level Panel on Women's Economic Development and the Human Rights Committee within the UN General Assembly. She was awarded the Medal of the Order of Australia in 2019. Welcome, Elise. It is great to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
And we are all so delighted to have Millie Rooney with us today. I think some of our listeners will know Millie. She has been with us on the pod before. Always fantastic conversations. Millie is coordinator of Australia Remade, an independent, not for-profit leadership network, where Australian civil society leaders can collaborate with one another and engage in long-term proactive agenda setting. It's a really exciting initiative. Millie's research background focuses particularly on local community and social norms around neighbourhood sharing and community building, and she gained her PhD in urban studies and cultural geography from the University of Tasmania. Millie, great to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
And so, Millie, let's start with talking about Australia Remade. This organisation that you coordinate has a vision of reimagining and remaking Australia based on your discussions with people around the country about the future that they hope for and that they dream of. Where does caring for one another fit into that vision of a future Australia?
Oh, I mean, I think caring is central to that vision, really, and in so many different ways. You know, we've got the first pillar, we've got 9 pillars of Australia Remade for the vision. And pillar one is a first people's heart. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and cultures are celebrated at the very heart of what it means to be Australian. You know, and that's about, you know, the long history of care for this country and the ongoing culture. And then pillar number two is a natural world for now and the future. It's care for the environment, for the planet, for place, and so on and so on. And one of the really key parts of it is about time to care and to be cared for. And in conversations that we've had with, you know, hundreds of conversations, ongoing conversations with people across the country, you know, care, whether it's health care, mental health care, care for our elderly, places where young people can be cared for and valued, you know, disability care, care for children, it, you know, care and love, you know, are the heart of what people talk about. And we joke about, you know, we don't hear everybody saying, oh, you know, we want jewel encrusted bathtubs. We want care. They're very different things, and care is what people talk about.
Elise, as I said when I was introducing you, a lot of your work has focused on care, a lot of your research. And as we're already starting to see, care is such an essential part of the human condition. We all need care and we all provide care. Care can be a burden and it's often presented as a burden, but it's also an incredible joy. Based on your research, Elise, how do you define care?
I think there's various different ways in which we can sort of think of care, but I really like Millie's way of looking at it in thinking of it quite broadly. So, you know, it is the care of people, but it's also the care of country also. And that's very much, you know, coming from First Nations literature as well, about how important care of country is to understanding, yeah, this concept of care. But I guess that, you know, other sort of more sort of pointed ideas around care as a part of what gets known as social reproduction. So it's all the things that we do to keep us alive. And actually, all of that work underpins the economy, because if we don't have people that are alive and healthy and growing up, and little people, you know, developing into bigger people who will pay taxes, et cetera, then we don't have an economy. So, you know, care, I think, it's nice to think of it in a very broad sense, but we also need to acknowledge how much it sustains the life systems that we rely on, including the economy.
Millie, you've mentioned the 9 pillars for Australia Remade, and they're highly recommended. I really recommend people listening, if you have not checked out this organisation, to have a look through the work that's done. The 4th pillar identifies a good society where all contributions count and where jobs has dignity. And you note that paid employment is not the only pathway towards worthiness, recognition and success. How well do we recognise contributions that are about caring rather than what's described as productive contribution through paid employment?
Oh, I think we do it really terribly. You know, I think you just have to listen to a lot of my peers who are parents, and you ask them, oh, what do you do? Oh, nothing. I'm just a parent. Or, you know, the care that a lot of my community takes for each other, it's fitted into the, you know, the slivers of leftover life is where care gets put. And to name, you know, you're not always paid for your care work, and we're not even given time to do that care work, I think. And so it's interesting hearing Elise talk about the economy, because one of the things I'm really passionate about is how do we make space to value care without it having to explicitly contribute to the economy. And in my PhD research, one of the things that was really interesting was this idea of kind of social debt and the social debt of care. So that if, you know, you can exchange things, I can go to the supermarket and I can buy a toothbrush, but I can't go and buy community care. Someone can't come to my house, have a cry, and then I don't say, oh, thank you, $50 for my contribution to community care. You know, it kills that relationship. But I have to then personally choose to make the time to be available to my community to turn up on my doorstep and cry. And we don't validate that as real work. And, you know, my own way of pushing back on that has been when I'm in meetings often with more senior people and everyone's introducing themselves as, you know, I'm the director of X, I'm the CEO of Y, you know, I'll say, well, I'm Millie, I'm the national coordinator for Australia Remade, and I'm also a carer, and I consider that legitimate work. You can't pay me to do that work, but I am going to put a stake in the ground and say, this takes my time. And so I think I feel like that takes courage to do. I feel really nervous every time I do that. It does instantly change the conversation in the room and people soften and become more human. But I think as a society, we're very unpracticed at valuing care outside of, you know, the economic framework of carer as, you know, paid child carer or nurse. I mean, and even paid is very undervalued.
Do you think we do it better in some areas? So particularly for unpaid caring, are there some areas where we acknowledge that better than in others?
I think parents as carers is gained, you know, has really gained more legitimacy as valuable care work that's unpaid. But I still don't think we're very good at valuing the care that is the glue care, you know, the care that is our community, the care that is expressions of love and that goes beyond connection to family, you know. I don't have my own children, but I'm deeply connected in almost a family way to a lot of community. And we don't even have a language for those relationships of care.
I really like that phrase, glue care. It's great.
Elise, I wanted to unpack where the economy fits within all of this and where the economy should fit within all of this. You've looked in your research about the ways in which society and also the economy is deeply dependent on unpaid care work. And Millie raised that really fundamentally important issue of whether we should be thinking about care in economic terms. But of course, when we don't give things economic value, we sometimes don't get the traction. So we have this dilemma. How do we begin to talk about the value of care in a way that really legitimizes the deep human importance of it, but also gets us into those spaces where we can get the ear of decision makers? So, Elise, can you just talk us a little bit through the way in which you've addressed this in your research in thinking about that relationship of care to the economy and to economic prosperity, as well as to society and people?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the first thing to say is that when we're talking about the economy, we're talking about a specific type of a specific economic system, and that, you know, we know as capitalism. And I guess, you know, in that formula and in that system, care is subjected to what Millie's talking about, the sort of what gets talked as, you know, the real work, the sort of productive work that is in the economy that gets valued, that gets paid, but yet care is so foundational to capitalism that it allows people to grow, people, you know, the glue that Millie talks about, the social glue that keeps people functioning together, surviving and feeling connected. All of that is super important for the economic system that is capitalism to exist. Now, the way in which that work, that care work, is seen as secondary is a major tension within the economic system that we have, and why we see that it gets devalued, the unpaid care gets devalued, but also the paid care gets devalued. It has a sort of a flow-on effect to, you know, the important work, the caring work that people do as jobs is largely underpaid. But it is really skilled, really important, really difficult work in a lot of cases, but yet gets undervalued in the monetary sense. So but then there is this sort of argument of, well, why do we need to value care in monetary terms? And I think that is a really important point. I think, though, with the current economic system, I think it's important to acknowledge what's there already to be able to move past where we are now. And I think in terms of using monetary value to talk about care and saying, well, actually, you know, it is at least about, its contribution is at least about 50% of GDP. The last time you surveyed, depending on how it was measured, it comes to around about that. You know, that's quite a breathtaking number to go, whoa, that is a huge amount of unpaid work that gets, that is generated by people living here that gets unpaid and is not largely not seen, but absolutely exists. So I think by using these monetary terms can be useful to acknowledge what's here, but only so far as that then we can move beyond it and think about the different ways in which we can rework the economy so that care is not just secondary to these capitalist understandings of work, but actually it's acknowledged for its own good and its own contribution.
Alisa, I wanted to just stay with you just for a minute and but to go back and to pick up on a point that Millie made about the importance of caring and actually stating that you are a carer as part of the work that you do, but also part of the life that you lead and the love that you have. One of the things that I often observe in a workplace is that women are very reticent to say, I'm caring for my child, I'm a mother, I have these responsibilities, I have to go and do these things for my children. They'll just try to juggle things but not speak about it. Increasingly, as men have taken on more of that caring role for children, which is such a great thing, I very often hear men in professional environments saying, I have to go and pick my children up, so I have to leave this meeting early. And there's often a kind of silent applause around that. And I think that's a great thing, that men are looking after children and being able to look after children. But we do see that real gender difference where women feel much more reticent and much more concerned that it's going to undermine their professional position if they say that they are carers. So I think we've got some real challenges there. But this, of course, is really exacerbated for single mothers. And Elise, you've done a lot of work around this and you've drawn on Nancy Fraser's concept of freeloading to critique the way in which single mothers in particular are stigmatised for not being in the labour force and the way in which systems will often prevent single mothers from being able to care for their children and give the time that they want to caring. Can you just talk us through how this plays out?
Yeah, I mean, sure. And I think you're absolutely right, Sharon, this sort of role of gendered norms and how they regulate, you know, how people feel and the different roles that people are meant to take on. And if we are moving towards a sort of an economic system that centres care, absolutely gendered norms need to be targeted and sort of reworked so that everybody can do care work and everyone can feel good about doing care work. And because, like you rightly point out, our current sort of the status quo is there are a lot of groups who are actually deterred from doing their care work. First Nations people, absolutely, living on country, living remotely, doing unpaid care of country. A lot of people are disregarded as being not productive, not in the labour force, and are subjected to very harsh, it's called the Community Development Program. It's a very harsh work for the dole program, targeted at First Nations people. It's so bad that the government's now scrapping it and they're reworking a new idea, which we're all worried about what will come out. But you know, that's a group that's been deterred from doing care of country. But as you rightly point out, single parents and particularly single mums also, we have a program at the moment called Parents Next that targets predominantly single mothers. And it's a form of welfare conditionality also, where it's compulsory. So you have to turn up to specific activities that are meant to get you job ready, but often aren't. There's sort of a confusion around the point of the activities, where a lot of people that are forced to go to them see them to put it bluntly, a waste of time. So interviews that I've done with women being put on this program see that it's a real hurdle, it's a real stress. And, of course, if you don't comply with these conditions, then your money can be can be suspended. But at the heart of what this program is and my sort of analysis of it is this sort of deterrence where single mums, you know, are looking after their kids for a variety of reasons. A lot of them are very skilled, have been in the labour market and have taken time out for various reasons to look after their children, some often because they have no choice, that childcare is expensive even with rebates, that the kind of work that they could do around their childcare caring, you know, is very precarious. You know, it doesn't fit in with looking after their kids. And often women are moved away from relationships because they have been, you know, violent relationships. So finding themselves in, you know, being single parents and doing the care work, but yet having to deal with this program, a government program that does not see their care work at all and sees them as unemployed and thus needing to be compelled into the labour market. It does not value the work that these women are doing. It completely disregards that work. So there's a real tension there. And then, of course, they're punished for their caring work, which is, I think, a really terrible outcome for public policy.
Millie, we're talking here about stigmatisation and discrimination on the basis of working as a carer. How can we flip that narrative? Can we use some imagination? Can we change that particular perspective?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, I was thinking as Elise was talking there that part of the challenge here, I think, is zooming out and thinking, well, why are we talking about care? Why do we value care? What is the, you know, what's the public good we're trying to create or maintain here? You know, what's the environment we need to create for care to flourish? So thinking about zooming back there. And, you know, one of the extraordinary things about Biden's jobs plan is that the very second point there is infrastructure for care or infrastructure of care. And he talks there, you know, it talks about creating more jobs for particularly women of color who are most often in those low paid care jobs, because we need people in our society to be cared for and because we need an infrastructure to enable people to care. And so thinking again, you know, Elise's comments about single parents and how do we have a context where you don't have to get paid specifically for the hours of care you put into caring for your own child, but you get paid because we think care is an important activity for people to participate in. So here's some, you know, maybe it's a universal basic income or maybe it's something else, but in the same way that, you know, the arts are valuable because art is valuable, you know, care is valuable because care and being cared for is valuable. How do we free up that space? So I think, you know, thinking about care not as just how do we break it down into the individual pieces of care we can pay for, but how do we see, you know, I love that idea of infrastructure of care because it gives us scope to be more imaginative in that, I think.
I think that's a great spot for us to take a short break and we'll be back in a moment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Welcome back. We're here with Elise Klein and Millie Rooney, and we're talking about the value of caring. Millie, the Royal Commission into Aged Care in Australia revealed some fairly horrific and shocking abuses of older people living in aged care. The stories that people told were heartbreaking. We spoke last week on the podcast with Diane Gibson and Nick Bedell about that particular Royal Commission, and they had some quite remarkable insights to share. If listeners want to check that out, it's available online. And of course, we've heard similar terrible stories around the abuse of children who've been in institutional care. How do we begin that transformation where the most vulnerable people in our society are genuinely cared for? How can we make this space?
Oh, I feel like that's a very big question.
We're feeling good that we're asking the big questions here and recognising that there might not be answers, but yeah. We start the conversation.
I mean, there's so many different levels of that. You know, there's the stuff that we've talked about of you know, valuing care and also valuing humans, you know, whoever you are. And I think that's in the conversations I've had recently with a lot of people around the idea of the public good. You know, what public good do you want available to you in your community? I'm hearing particularly across age, but so often the very first thing that the, you know, younger people, the 20-year-olds will say to me is, I want a place for our older people to be safe, to be in community, to participate. And until we have that cultural shift, you know, one of the things we have to do is that cultural shift of recognizing everybody counts, you know, everyone has something that is inherently valuable and worthy of care. And, you know, again, that comes back to how we value contribution to society. You can contribute in a way that isn't, you know, paid work. You can contribute as an older person by just being in the space and being, you know, having a history and a story and a, you know, a mentoring role. So I think part of it is being more imaginative about how we love our communities. And I think also taking profit out of care, you know, that would be the number one thing that I think is a, you know, pattern in all of those horrific discoveries in these royal commissions is profit has been prioritized over people and privatization of things that shouldn't be for profit. So really actually stepping back and asking, why are we doing this? What is the purpose? I think is really important. So that, you know, how we change the culture of how we view each other and taking the money out, or at least the big profits.
Mm. Millie, I think that issue of profit is exactly where we wanted to go with this conversation. And we've already raised the C word, that capitalism is the system that we are operating within. But I think this is one of the really striking features of what we might call 21st century capitalism, is just that financialization and that profitization of all things, including care. And you know, we see that coming up again and again, particularly around aged care, but also around disability and a whole range of other issues that really impact on people's lives. Elise, can I ask you for your thoughts on this and how that financialization and profitization is impacting on the way we think about caring and the way we carry out caring?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of goes to those points that Millie raised right at the start around, you know, care is the glue that holds us together. It's so important and it's so foundational. It's the, you know, it's the feeling of connectedness. It's the feeling of, you know, having people around that look out for you, that you look after people. It's the glue work. And I guess that is stuff that does not translate into, you know, a profit for profit environment. And when it does, it becomes secondary to the bottom line of profit. And so I think, you know, taking profit out of these privatized systems, I think is a really, really important point that Millie raises. And something that really, if we move towards wanting to center care, that we need to look at these systems that are trying to destabilize that glue work in a way, and it comes at a detriment to the people in the center of it. And I think, you know, the other thing is that acknowledging that people are contributing all the time. And you know, I mean, my grandmother passed last year, and I would go to see her in her nursing home, and you know, it was extraordinary. I mean, there was people there that were paid, a lot of paid people at low rates. But then there was also a lot of volunteers, people who just went about using their own time, unpaid care, that would come in and spend time with my grandmother, but also others that were in the home. And it was it made her day constantly. And you know, it's all of that work that is outside of the, it's almost that work was propping up the actual nursing home system, if you know what I mean. It's all these people, all this unpaid work that was keeping people feeling good and carrying on in their lives. So, you know, I think acknowledging all of this, all of the cared work, and having, I think, some form of, I mean, I echo Millie's point around sort of a basic income. Colleagues and I have been working on this idea of a livable income guarantee. So it is a form of basic income, but there would be some sort of acknowledgement around the contribution that people are making to society, to each other, and care work would be foundational to that. You know, I think all of that provides a space to which people can have their time back to be able to engage in this important work that's sort of, you know, outside of what gets called the real economy, but actually foundational to it. And then we can move towards something else when people get their time back.
Some of our listeners will remember that we had a mini series last year on the wellbeing economy and the kinds of issues that are emerging here we focused on during that series. So listeners, if you're finding this interesting, go back and have a listen to that Wellbeing Economy series. I think there's so much there that's picking up on these themes. And one of the themes that we talked about was a basic income. And Millie, I'm interested to get your thoughts on two parts of the story that's emerging here. One is basic income and whether a basic income is a mechanism to help to ensure that people have the time to be able to engage in the kinds of care work that they want to do within their families, within their communities. But the other part of this story seems to be the very low wages received by many people who do paid care work and the increasing precariousness of that work, as much of that work is casualised and very uncertain. So I'm just really interested to hear your thoughts on those two parts of this. Firstly, whether basic income would make a difference, but also this real problem of precariousness and low pay.
Yeah, so I think in terms of the basic income, you know, you can do a basic income very badly. So I don't think it's necessarily the silver bullet. It's, again, it's how we do it, why we do it, the purpose and values driving it, and the context that it happens in. So, you know, it would be all very well to say here's a payment for everyone in Australia, but that we want to make sure that that's then not an excuse to dismantle the public healthcare system or to you know, dismantle other forms of caring. So I think just being really clear that any sort of UBI or anything like that has to be situated within a broader context of care. And, you know, I'm not across the, you know, the details of how that would work, but I really do think it's worth interrogating as an idea with care at the core, because I do think the instant we, you know, like my example of someone crying at my door and me saying thank you $50, like we kill my ability to do that care work if I start to charge for it, because it's the sticky relationships, it's the unclear relationships that enable us to do that care as humans rather than as clients or customers. So I think any kind of infrastructure of care, again to use that language, is really worth thinking about, and that requires us as a country to work out what is at the core of why we do what we do. And in terms of then the low wages for paid care, I mean, automatically was actually thinking, what if you were someone, so, you know, to be transparent, I have a husband with a disability and I'm a carer for him. So, you know, this is obviously very close to my heart, but thinking about the stress that comes with living with someone who requires different care to a normal partner, you know, I'm very lucky, I have work, he's got enough ability to mostly look after himself on the day-to-day things. If I myself was in really precarious work, the added stress to my life of needing a different kind of care in my family setup and having financial stress, and then if we were a family that needed the NDIS, imagining people coming in to support in ways that was precarious for them, you know, like the flow on effects aren't just that carers themselves are in precarious positions. It's what that does for their own lives, for their own ability to care, because it's often people who, you know, are juggling multiple things in this work. And then again, the way that it it makes invisible the humanness of the people who are being cared for. And I think that's a real tension I have. I'd love Elise's thoughts on this, of like how we juggle. We, you know, on the one hand, I'm really passionate about not putting dollar value on care. On the other hand, we really need to put dollar value on care and security to make sure that there is care work that does need people in secure paid positions to deliver. So I think we've somehow got to find a story that unites those parts.
Elise, let's hear your thoughts on this. How do we value caring by value caring?
Yeah, I mean, just one thing about the precariousness and the basic income. I do think everything Millie said, I totally agree with. I do think a basic income has a possibility of providing people an economic floor to stand on, to which to push back against low paid work. So, you know, and I think that would really help the paid caring sector, where if you had a basic income, so you weren't forced into destitution if you refused low paid work, that you could bargain and you could push back for better valued care, paid care work, as well as, or you could use that economic floor to use your time to engage in whatever care work you liked. Outside of that, I think the tricky bit in there, though, is this thing about gendered norms and needing to rework gendered norms so we don't end up in a system where, you know, it's just women on basic income doing unpaid care work, which is low pay, which would be comparatively low paid to all the paid work out there. So, you know, we need to sort of liberate care and redistribute care so that everybody can engage in that work, not just so it's gendered. And then in terms of valuing care, look, I kind of see it in terms of using the master's tools to reconfigure a different economy. And that's the point of why you would put a dollar value on unpaid care work. It's about using the master's tools to be able to say, hey, look how much we rely on this. Look how important it is. And it's also important for all these other reasons, and it has all sorts of important contributions to a world where we're faced with growing inequalities, where we're faced with climate change, and care really needs to be a central feature of an economy that's fit for purpose for, you know, the climate changed future that we're well and truly into.
Caring economics, I can see the model emerging. Millie, the first of Australia Remade's pillars, and you mentioned it at the beginning of this conversation, is around Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and the culture that's celebrated at the very heart of what it means to be Australian. We've all, I think, touched a little on some of the extraordinary knowledge that we can gain from listening to Indigenous voices, particularly when they talk about caring for country. But I wondered if you might share with us some of the discussions you've had with people around Australia on the importance of this principle.
Yeah, so I mean, this comes up in every conversation, well, not every conversation, many, many of the conversations that we have. And I think there is an increasing connection between the language of care and a recognition and I think an awe of the history on this continent of care for such a long time. And I don't think we've even begun to grapple with the significance of that. And, you know, I think also in the conversations we have around care is making sure that we also don't just separate out First Nations and care as being about country, but also recognizing, you know, I had this amazing conversation with a woman, you know, who was speaking about mental health care. She was a First Nations woman, and she was saying, you know, we need healthcare systems that recognize that mental, you know, managing mental health is access to country, and it's access to country is not, you know, that means kind of reconfiguring leave from work. It's reconfiguring transport to get access to country. But she was in a rural area and was talking about how difficult, you know, public transport access was. So thinking about what care means, you know, in a historical way, in a culturally relevant way, you know, again, it's this, we need this imagination about what care means. And, you know, even it's a bit of a wild thing, but, you know, I saw a GP once in the middle, you know, I was in the middle of my PhD, I was really stressed, and she said, you know, I think you just need to go for a swim in the sea. And, you know, I have to say it really helped. I mean, you know, I know there's sort of, you know, medical practitioners prescribing forest walks and all of those sorts of things. But, you know, that would be an interesting way of connecting, you know, environment and care and just being more imaginative and more expansive in our thinking of how these two things overlap. I think there's something in that imagination and that awe of recognition of the history that is on this land.
Elise, we hear from Millie there about the deep value and the awe. I love that word, that description, mm-hmm. that many non-Indigenous Australians have for First Nations culture. But of course, we see many policies that don't value or celebrate First Nations peoples and cultures. And many of those policies have had a really devastating impact. And the cashless debit card is one such policy. And Elise, you've done a lot of work around this. I wonder if you can share with us your thoughts on how we begin to rethink our policy frames. So rather than disregarding or being punitive of First Nations cultures, we actually begin to respect, value, and learn from those cultures.
Yeah, I mean, I think something like the cashless debit card, but also, you know, the community development program, that really harsh Work for the Dole program in remote Australia, you know, these are all examples of, you know, I guess really decare. I remember when Malcolm Turnbull went to announce the continuation of the cashless debit card trial, he called it tough love. And it was really weird for me to hear that because, I mean, everything I had seen in my research but also others around the cashless debit card looked at how much these punitive policies completely disrupt the ways in which community and individuals care for each other and are enduring in a settler colonial situation. So, you know, everything Millie's saying, I'm on board with. And I think there's also needs to be an acknowledgement of the amount of care work that First Nations people have to do to endure under a settler colonial regime where, you know, colonisation never finished here in Australia, that First Nations people didn't get independence like you saw, say, in other places around the world, that continues. And, you know, we see all sorts of policies implemented on First Nations people that have all sorts of terrible effects, and the cashless debit card is just one. And so, you know, the amount of work that people do in community to keep language alive, to keep connected to country, to keep community alive and thriving, you know, I gave evidence for the 13 deaths of young people across the East Kimberley, and, you know, suicide was a major part of that inquest. And the amount of work that people do to keep their young people feeling hopeful and connected is huge. And this is and that work is largely not seen. And that is, I guess, in a way, it is care work. But also, I mean, just in terms of the work that gets put into caring for country, to which, you know, our whole economy thrives on, you know, resource extraction and extraction out of First Nations land. And we need to sort of see the ways in which First Nations peoples, and it's not just culture, but the ways in which they and have looked after this place is used by the sort of settler nation. And we really must, I think, be a little bit critical about that, but also celebrate the extraordinary endurance that First Nations people have done, but also honour people instead of being a sort of a deficit model of saying, well, you know, that this is not happening, this is not happening. We need to sort of tell the truth about the situation where people are enduring under extraordinary circumstances that they have endured since, you know, white people got here. And we need to reconfigure policy to honour the sovereignty and to honour the care work that's been going on, not make it harder for people.
Really important ideas about how we can acknowledge cultural significance. We might just come quickly to a global context, because these issues that we've been talking about in the Australian context are, I think, relevant globally. The International Labour Organization has focused attention on the problems of paid work and care work by arguing that the world paid care work remains characterized by a void of benefits and protections, low wages and not or non-compensation, and exposure to physical, mental, and in some case sexual harm. Millie, as we're thinking about how we can remake Australia, how can we also reimagine the value of care in all its forms globally?
Do Do you throw me the big questions? I thought remaking Australia was big enough. Far out.
I think some of what you've already done gives us great ideas about how to change the world.
I think it comes back to thinking about what we mean by care and what do we put at the heart of why we do what we do. You know, is it profit? Is it power? Is it care? You know, it's obviously complicated how these things relate, but, you know, immediately I'm thinking about the COVID context and vaccines and vaccine patents and who's got access to, you know, we're really all connected, you know. It's not just the right thing to do to make sure other countries have access to vaccines. Like, to care for ourselves, we need to care for others. So, and I think Biden is certainly, you know, the care infrastructure, the power that the US has to signal simply by putting it there. I'm really surprised it hasn't been picked up more particularly in progressive media in Australia as an example of the way we can, you know, care is infrastructure. I think we talked about the gendered stuff, you know, infrastructure tends to be that masculine stuff of, you know, bridges and sewage systems and, you know, the way we weirdly gender these things. Like, infrastructure isn't associated with care. So I think there is something there globally as well about, you know, what would a global infrastructure of care look like? And thinking through the things around patents and profit and extractivism and, but that's very radical, you know, and partly I think it's starting to just develop a shared language that we use to frame these discussions and pull ourselves up when we start to go down the profit extractivist route, even when we think it's helpful. Like, how do we also give an opportunity to reframe?
Elise, I wanted to bring you in here and think particularly about the global development context. And global care chains are the entwined global processes of women from less advantaged circumstances undertaking care work to enable other women to engage in different activities and fulfill different responsibilities. And of course, there's a very heavily gendered element to this, and we see the way in which the responsibility for caring is falling onto women. UN Women, amongst others, have argued that the vicious cycle of care, inequality and exclusion must be broken. I'd be really keen, as we kind of start to draw this conversation to a close, to hear your thoughts on how global care chains can be exploitative, but perhaps more importantly, in terms of looking forward, how we can start to rethink some of the practices that give rise to those global care chains.
Yeah, I mean, it is a really, you know, a very stark, I think, illustration of how interconnected we are globally. And, you know, whilst we've been talking about care in Australia, we actually, you know, we are talking about care in the world because we're just so connected. And global care change is one example, you know. And I think this sort of, as the sort of breadwinner model of the 60s has sort of moved and you know, middle-class women in global north countries have moved predominantly into paid work, there's been a huge gap of who does that care work now. And so we've gone into childcare, and we send children to childcare, but who does that work in the childcare? And, you know, what we're seeing is that a lot of Global South women, not just in Australia, but beyond, are doing that work, are filling that sort of void that middle-class women used to do when it was expected that you'd be, women wouldn't be in the workforce and you'd live off the one male earner wage. So you see over time this shift where the caring responsibilities are shifting now to Global South women who are doing that work, and their children and their caring responsibilities are being filled in by elderly members of the family and other sort of social networks at home. So you see the ways in which we are totally connected. And I think, you know, instead of sort of saying, well, you know, care is the problem here, that is really important work. I think we go back to that sort of conversation that we had at the start and talking about what the global economic system is and why it is that care is seen as a secondary piece of the economic picture and why it's not a fundamental central piece to the economic picture. And I think, you know, this sort of concern, you know, of global precariousness more broadly, I think think that's definitely also part of the picture, that you know, this sort of promise of development, that, you know, full employment will be reached by, you know, there will be jobs for people if countries just develop, has actually largely failed across the world. That the informal economy is the formal economy, if you like. That is the majority's experience of working life, is not having economic security at all, not having social protections. And so, you know, this has been a patterning of the global economy since colonization, and the sort of ways in which those processes have patterned the way in which the global economy has progressed. So, you know, thinking about the ways in which people can have economic security and disrupting those gendered norms that are across the world, I think is all really important work.
I think we could continue this conversation for hours, and I'm so glad to have had Millie and Elise with us talking today about the value of caring. We're coming to our last question, and we do like to finish the conversation by coming back to where we are now. I'm maintaining cautious optimism that we live in a time where our policymakers are open to new ideas and where the time for a new framework is still with us. So can I ask both of you, if you were to give one piece of advice to policymakers on how we begin the process of genuinely valuing care, what would that be?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say implement a livable income guarantee. And we just saw that they can do something very close, very quickly. They got rid of mutual obligations and increased people's social security payments with the COVID supplement, which got most people above the poverty line overnight. So that in effect, that those two measures were like a basic income during COVID. And so I would say, let's do that and let's do it quick and let's keep it there. And I think that would provide people an economic floor, so then we can start more work around, you know, reconfiguring and recentering care in the economy.
Millie?
Oh, I mean, the simplest thing I think is taking profit out of care. You know, that's the first thing. People before profit, you know, no questions. And then there's a whole lot of cultural change. But I think, yeah, taking the profit motive out of how we care for people is one way to say people are important. Everyone is important. No one person should profit off another person's need to be human.
A beautiful way to finish. Thank you so much, Elise and Millie, for joining us today on a conversation around the central importance of caring in the lives that we all lead.
Thank you.
Anna Greta, that was a fantastic conversation. Both of us have been wanting to get Elise and Millie onto the pod to have this conversation for a very long time, and it was worth the wait. What did you think?
Oh, absolutely. For me, this is actually part of the ongoing conversation that has been going through the podcast discussions we've had this year and in a number of the other places that I've been working, thinking about economics and thinking about the role that it plays in our society. I think the experience of the last year or so has shown us that we're allowed to challenge some of the norms that have come into our society, and Elise and Millie have done a superb job of showing us that relationship between value and consumption, our economic model, and the way in which it doesn't fully contend with what the one of Millie's great phrases, the messiness of humanity, that our lives are socially connected, that putting monetary value on a lot of what matters to us is not at all straightforward, and that we have an extraordinary opportunity at this moment in time to reframe and rethink.
Yeah, I think that sense of an opportunity at the moment is really important. And we, to some extent, missed that opportunity last year as we grappled with how to deal with COVID, and we had the language of bounce back or snap back or whatever that language was. But we did see, as Elise said, some really interesting policy experimentation that meant we lifted so many people out of poverty and then made the decision to plunge them back again. But we still have that moment, I think, to really reconsider, as you say, the kinds of values that we want to have underpinning our society. And for me, out of that conversation, there are a couple of really important things. One is the importance of thinking about gendered roles and responsibilities. And I think this has to move beyond the conversation about who does the work in a kind of antagonistic way, to think about how we genuinely redistribute care in ways that value that care and value people and the fact that both women and men often want to do caring work or want to play caring roles but don't always have the same opportunities. Mm. And for women, it often becomes a burden. So how do we really shift that in a meaningful way? As you said, Anna-Greta, and as Millie made the point, how do we get the profit out of care and how do we value care in ways that don't connect it to profit? And the other thing that I just flag and put on the agenda here is Elise talked about universal basic income, but I think we've also got to think about universal basic services and how important those services are to care and ensuring that everyone has access to those services and the people who provide those services are well remunerated and valued for them.
Mm, absolutely. So I think this is another one that gives us more food for thought and more themes that will come up again over the course of the rest of this year and into next year. Listeners, thank you so much for joining us today. We really value your thoughts and reflections on the work that we're doing. And you can reach out to us on Twitter at APPS Policy Forum or APPS Policy Forum, or you can email us at podcast@policyforum.net. If you're on Facebook and you'd like to join the Facebook group, you can type Policy Forum Pod into the search bar on Facebook and join into our group. If you're listening to this through your podcast platform, please don't forget to subscribe and please leave us a review. We're always interested to hear feedback and thoughts and particularly how well or otherwise we're doing. We will be back next week with another episode. I think next week we'll actually be reflecting on the Royal Commission into National Natural Disasters and thinking about the bushfire experience and what we might learn going forward. And I think we've got some more exciting stuff coming up after that.
Absolutely. Something to keep people warm during the cold months ahead.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So goodbye from Anna-Greta Hunter.
And from me, Sharon Bessel. Bye-bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.